First case on the calendar is 9-19, Thomas Bar Association versus Walter Brooks. Mr. Brooks. You make it first.
Morning, Your Honor. I'm Walter Brooks. Here I'll let the reserve of 5 minutes from the time when it starts to the position by the Thomas Bar Association in this case. As I indicated, I have been in Brooks now. I have provided checks to the Thomas Bar Association, heirs, the amount of $25,000, and then to the Thomas Bar Association also for Mrs. Victoria Jackson and Mr. Raymond Jackson Sr. in the amount of $2,672. I would like to state that in the Jackson case, obtained by Mrs. and Mrs. Jackson, Victoria and Senior, representing her son, who was at Finley College in Tennessee, Ohio, who had been attacked by police officers in the city of Finley. Mr. Jackson found guilty of resisting arrest in the municipal court. That decision was appealed, and the appeals court upheld the decision in terms of finding Mr. Jackson guilty of resisting arrest. The case came to me on the verge of the statute of limitations expiring. I recall correctly, 2 or 3 days, the statute would expire because of the action. With the approval of Mrs. Jackson, although I knew that the case and the jurisdiction of the Northern District of Ohio, I chose to file the case in the Southern District of Ohio for several reasons. One, thinking that I may not be able to get the case filed in a timely fashion in Toledo. I recall, Friday and Saturday, the case was filed on Monday or Tuesday. And also because of the expense that the objection would occur by filing the case in the Northern District of Ohio. The opposing counsel, once the case was filed, he and I discussed the case being filed in Columbus, Ohio. And with the approval of the judge on the case, jurisdiction was agreed to be here in the city of Columbus. We went through pretrial hearings, and the opposing counsel and I get set a schedule for discovery, taking depositions, etc. The attorney for the defendants, the police officers in the city of Finland, and the police chief indicated to me that he filed a motion for summary judgment, and at that point, having experienced the Federal District Court in the area of civil rights, and especially experienced with motion for summary judgment, I knew that the likelihood of success would be not great unless we vigorously prepared our case from an officer standpoint or a defense standpoint. We went through the process of taking depositions, interrogatories, and prior to that, I had the Jackson sign a fee agreement which provided for a non-refundable $500. And the reason for that was the dollar fee was $125. The fee for researching the case, the law specifically drafting the complaint, serving the complaint made of the difference after the $125 was deducted from the $550. The case then was filed. After the motion, after we discussed the schedule in terms of briefing, what we did was we, being my law clerk, and I met with Mrs. Jackson, Victoria, and got her approval to involve my law clerk in all aspects of the case. My error, I would definitely admit that was not documented that in terms of a letter to Mrs. Jackson or a supplemental contract for her sign. And even though I lost track of that, and I would have rather get that to this court. The court, being Judge Merritt, ruled in favor of Mr. Jackson and against the defendants, being police officers, police chief, and city attorney. We went into mediation at the direction of the court. The case was settled for some $30,000. That was with the approval of Mrs. Jackson. If the court would review the record, being exhibits 2B3, the court will see my privilege statements, the court will see the distribution sheets, and of course the contract, which is exhibit 1. Monies were distributed on exhibit 3 of the call directly to the office Jackson Jr., the student at Finley College of Community University at that time. Was in need of a car. I put it in brackets on the exhibits, provided additional dollars to him so that he would be able to purchase a vehicle. I received a complaint through the this court's class security funds, mediator, administrator, I should say. I provided documentation to that mediator. I met with that mediator and Mrs. Markle specifically, and it was determined at that time from her standpoint that nothing had been done properly. The plaintiff was then filed with the Closed Bar Association. I met the two representatives of the bar and explained to them at that time that if there were any monies which I owed to Mrs. and Mr. Jackson Sr., I would be able to pay those dollars. I followed that letter up by way, I got a response from my then attorney, the West Carolina, and I met with members of the Bar Association again. I renewed my request. I got nothing in terms of response as to what I owed to the Jacksons, former plaintiff's office then, which brings me at least before this court today. The Jackson, I've submitted a breach to some court in terms of excessive fee, I should say. I am submitting that I did not charge an excessive fee when the Board of Commissioners on fiscal reasons indicated I paid it and was involved, I've done that. And that's also true in terms of the Ayers case. Moving to the Ayers case, before I filed the first complaint in the forthcoming treaties of Franklin County, I had discussed the matter with Mrs. Ayers' physician, who was a cancer specialist. It was another malpractice case. We thought that the intervening doctor had formally lowered the standard of care. When I filed the complaint, I failed to attach an affidavit. I dismissed that complaint, filed another complaint, and with that complaint was an affidavit where I had talked with Ms. Bayer's physician, who was a specialist, who had indicated to me that she felt the treating physician had called me low standard of care. Yes, John.
There's a lot of debate in our society about contingency fees and whether they should be good or bad or equal or helpful to people who can't afford attorneys. But always the argument for contingency fee is that if the lawyer takes the risk, that if the lawyer cannot recover, the lawyer ends up with zero. The lawyer can recover if the client, you know, has the benefit of having someone who kind of takes the risk of pursuing the case and they can't afford to pay an hourly fee. But in most of these cases, if I'm not correct, you had a deal where your client paid an hourly fee or a percentage of recovery. Whether they won, lost, whatever, you got an hourly fee, is that correct?
In the Jackson case, whether it was in the Harris case, my memory is not that there was a contingency agreement. Holly reached an agreement with Harris.
You had no agreement for, well, the refining state that you had a fee agreement similar to the first one, which was hourly contingency. And so you had a written fee agreement. Have you reviewed your written fee agreement in the Harris case?
Yes, Your Honor, I reviewed it, a fee agreement, but my recollection of that fee agreement was not, which was part of the evidence of the case. It was not a contingent fee agreement. The one that I had as a contingent was in the Jackson.
So you should use their findings as fact in the case.
I'm saying, Your Honor, I questioned the findings of fact because the contract between the plaintiff and the Ayers case was an hourly fee.
In the Jackson case, you took no risk, did you?
Your Honor, I beg to differ with that, in that during the time I represented the Jacksons, I performed services, and the Jacksons did not have the means of paying me. And that went on for a number of months, although the agreement that I had with Jackson called for the payment of a curriculum as well as Jackson's, and not...
Well, after the time of settlement, they already paid you $5,600, which is no small sum.
That's...
And you had already gotten settlement at that point, and they were paying you, and you had no risk.
Your Honor, up until the time of settlement, out of those $5,000, there were fees paid to the book court for both attendance and purchase and transfers. So the $5,000 that came to me out of those monies went to filing fees, out of those monies went purchase and transfers. I can't recall the specific dollar amount.
And out of those monies went more money into your pocket for our
I do not speak to this.
With the case, I did file the complaint with that indicating that I had spoken with a doctor.
At the time, I think it was a month or so before the motion for summary judgment was filed, the physician who had supported us all along provided me with a letter which became a part of the exhibits in this case, indicating that he felt that he would not be able to state that there was a failure to follow the standard of care violating Ms. Zayer's former position. At that time, I discussed the matter with Ms. Zayer. We got appointments at least three to meet with the doctor, discuss his reason for withdrawing, and each time the doctor canceled the appointments. We went forward, nevertheless, after filing the case whereby one could testify, and I discussed that case with Ms. Ayers, testified on his or her behalf, that's the treatment received and administered. I discussed the case with Ms. Ayers, indicated the cover goes to assess, would not be great. I was authorized to go forward to file a motion, file the answer to the summary judgment. When the answer was filed, it was filed with one judge, but the case was initially filed. After I filed the motion for the sixth time, I had a conversation both with the law clerk, all of that judge, which was coming to me in Franklin County. I was given the sixth time, and by some way, without my knowledge, the case was switched from that judge to a judge who indicated that the motion. My motion and under the contract would be stricken, and as a result, we were not able to respond to the motion for summary judgment. At that time, Ms. Mayor became aware of that decision. She made a decision to appeal the matter to the Court of Appeals, have a consultant with me, and again, advising her to chance of success. I thought would not be good because we still didn't have the medical support, and the lower court had addressed that. The appeal was saying, and that appeal was not successful. What I said to support in my brief or objections to the finding of the board of commissioner agreements and discipline is that in terms of the standard, I believe it has been shown, clearly missing, which is not involved by a preponderance of the evidence, not clear, but not beyond the reason about. That based upon what I have done in the case, I do not believe that the findings were supported by that theory.
Doesn't there have to be clear and convincing evidence to support a public reprimand? As well as a 6-month suspension?
Yes, sir.
You recommend or request in your brief, as I read it, that a public reprimand is appropriate.
I understand, yes, sir.
Doesn't that then ergo say that clear and convincing evidence has been presented?
Well, Your Honor, I do not believe that clear and convincing evidence has been presented. I'm saying...
Then you should want this dismissed.
That is true.
Because if you agree that a public reprimand is appropriate, haven't you conceded the argument about clear and convincing?
Well, in terms of argument, yes, sir.
Okay.
Any other questions on this other report?
Thank you, Mr. Brooks. Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Court, Mr. Brooks. It's an unusual honor to be able to argue a case first of this court, and I'll try not to abuse that privilege by asking your attention span. I will address count one. complaint, which involves the President Jackson matter. I will also address the issue of sanctions. Chief Ross, my colleague, will speak to count two of the errors in the medical malpractice matter. I'd like to note an error in our brief on page 5. I refer to Board Opinion 88-3. That should be 88-31. In the Jackson case, as he had done in the prior case, which led to his previous 6 months suspension by this court, the respondent received money to which he was not ethically entitled. First, he devised a fee contract which not only provided for a non-refundable retainer, but which also gave him the advantage of collecting an hourly rate of fees, win or lose the case, as Justice Stratton has observed, and then to receive a contingent fee at the end of the case if the contingency was greater than the hourly rate already collected. He then decided, and we believe unilaterally, on top of this, to orally modify the written fee agreement by allowing himself expenses for time expended by his law clerk and his secretary on this case. And he claims to have done so in order to save his client money. And then finally, as if all of that was not enough, he billed out his clerk's time to the client at a rate which was 3 times higher than he was actually paying. In effect, charging a 200% surcharge on the time that it actually cost him to provide the clerk's work.
Sounds like my plumber.
I'm sorry?
Sounds like my plumber.
I hope we won't be lowered to those standards. If your phone has anything with my phone.
Mr. Campbell, may I interrupt you just for a moment? I want to get something straight in my mind. It seems to me you just said that he had an hourly fee agreement and then a contingency fee contract if, in fact, the result was successful, and there would be a credit of the hourly fees against the amount of the contingency.
Yes.
Is that wrong?
Yes.
How does that violate the canons? I mean, I've often seen that done in civil rights cases because you can hardly ever win them. So I've seen them taken on the basis of an hourly fee. And then if you win, whatever the contingent fee is, you credit everything you've gotten under the hourly fee against the contingency. And I just want to know what canon that violates.
We believe that at least with an unsophisticated client, if we were talking about General Motors, I think maybe we could agree that a hybrid fee agreement could be arrived at, which would balance both the contingency and the hourly rate. But when you're dealing with a relatively unsophisticated client, as this one was, it seems to me that this is kind of having a technique too.
Well, but tell me.
Justification, again, as Justice Stratton has observed, one of the only justifications for a contingent fee is that the lawyer bears the risk along with the client. And in this case, the lawyer did not bear a risk.
But that's not always so. I mean, not always does the lawyer bear the risk in cases. You often take cases on an hourly basis, on the basis that you may or may not be successful. I guess I'm just amazed that I thought, as I read it, with regard to his other disciplinary matter, that there was clearly an overcharging. But it seems to me from your presentation that there was no duplication. So that let's assume the contingency fee contract called for 40%, and he got $30,000. He's entitled to $12,000. Is that right? Did he charge that $12,000 plus the $5,000 on an hourly basis? So he was entitled to a contingency fee on the total award, and if he credited everything that he got on an hourly basis, where has he sinned?
Well, our position is he shouldn't be entitled to a contingency fee unless he took the risk. He didn't take the risk. In fact, he gets a windfall on his hourly rate charge. This has been a substantially discounted hourly rate. That might be one thing, but in this case, he's charging a regular hourly rate, and on top, at the end of the case, he gets whatever the benefit of the contingency fee.
Is there, I understand the thesis that whether that seems unfair or whether that seems like good business and good contracting on the part of the lawyer, is there any case previously that says you can't do this?
I don't believe that this court had yet said that.
So really what you're asking is, it would be much larger than this lawyer, this offense. You're asking us to determine that this kind of contractual arrangement is a client. And I don't know whether it's extremely uncommon, whether this is one of the kind, or whether this is very common. I guess, pursuing what Justice Douglas was asking, it wouldn't take much imagination on my part to perhaps believe that, say, someone who is working in an area that's just very, very difficult to plumb costs, pretty tricky, and you either screen out most cases or you're going to be taking on a lot of cases in which the risk of recovery is very remote, but people who believe they have age discrimination cases, sexual discrimination cases, those kinds of things, can feel pretty passionate in a lawyer's office. And would it be, so you're asking us to put out a rule that says it is wrong for a lawyer to look at any kind of case like that and say, so the client, assume the conversation goes like this. Look, the client, your case looks very tough. You may have something that's going to cost a lot of my time and effort to investigate this. It's problematic. I'm willing to take this on if I get some assurance of compensation. If we go all the way through trial and we have a big hit, I want to convert that to a continued fee. And if you're asking us to say, can't do that, period. No time, under no circumstance. Even if that's what it takes to get a client to engage a lawyer.
I don't think we're going quite that far. I do certainly see that there may be circumstances in particular kinds of cases in which that kind of hybrid agreement may be proper if fully explained to a knowledgeable client, and that's what they're getting. In this case, we're talking about a standard form contract that the attorney was using in a number of cases,
including cases that would be that complex. For example, if you use this in a standard car wreck case where the liability seemed clear cut, it would seem unconscionable to do that. How do we write a rule that?
I think maybe the first thing the court needs to do is go back and look at its decision on Schultz, in which it alluded to this, and it talked about the risk of non-recovery.
So I wouldn't want him to think I was at the meeting, but let's take it to the practice of law. Associates are not compensated on an hourly rate to anything like what the firm bills if their time on case.
I understand that.
And so, again, if you're wanting us to write in this area and say, what's don't believe it's discriminating. You know, taking skills and drafting to get to the nub of what you say is wrong here without causing economic havoc for every law firm in the state.
Well, in the first place, we're talking about billing time that was not provided for during the contract. First place.
So just
and in second place, we're talking about a three hundred percent increase.
So shouldn't we just stop and saying it's something that wasn't provided for in the contract?
We certainly believe that was the case.
Because if we get into this business of market things up, that's pretty slippery slope at the same time.
And it would also be a slippery slope if lawyers started expensing what is commonly understood in the marketplace to be overhead.
Right.
He did not take the $2,000 out of the credit. It was on top of the 33%.
Yes, it was charged as an expense on the
You also, or the board also, and you argue that the non-refundable retainer, that's another part of this fear,
yes.
Is it not? That
in this particular case, that come into fruition because they got beyond the point where it's $500. By the way, I'd like to observe that was a $500 retainer. It doesn't say $500 to be used for case expenses. The contract provides that the client has paid those two, and ultimately did pay those. So $500 was pure fee, or at least under the terms of the contract.
So I guess you're asking us, or we're certainly presented with the question whether we should write on that issue, whether the ABA has certainly spoken to and other courts have, that even though here it wasn't used or didn't come into play, it was part of the contract, and I guess we should write something on that to say whether or not this is proper in Ohio. But
the board was written on that, and sort of certainly with regard to the issue of sanctions, we cited the Hubert case as the Hopper case as recent examples of cases with parallel sanctions. We originally argued for a 2-year suspension with a 1-year stay before found in favor of a 2-year suspension, 6 months, say. We are working with that. I'd like to reserve some time for Mr. Ross.
Mr. Ross?
Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Brooks, I'll be really brief, so I'll be quite late on. I'll address the Fatigue and Ears case, the complaint by Fatigue and Ears. This was a medical malpractice case. The first witness respondent was not well prepared. He had plenty of opportunity to obtain medical affidavit that would be necessary to sustain a motion against the summary judgment. He failed to do so with his expert witness, picked out basically. In his brief, he says he can find such witnesses for anywhere from $1 to $10,000, but he nowhere addresses the issue of whether he did obtain, or even tried to obtain such a witness to obtain him and have used it to stay on the motion for summary judgment. And in fact, he never did obtain such a motion. We maintain that inadequate preparation in the medical malpractice case, and that he truly violated the R6-1182. The next proposition concerns the manner in which he conducted these cases. He attempted to file this case in 3 different courts. And in the trial court, after the motion for summary judgment was filed, he obtained a 9-day extension. The reason 90 days, it was a 9-day extension. Then he got an additional 20-day extension. After that, he obtained no further extensions from time to file. And yet, it was 5 weeks after that that he finally filed the motion against the summary judgment, and the motion, again, did not contain the affidavit necessary to fight the motion successfully. The trial court found that delay to be inexcusable, as it was, and refused to entertain a memorandum that ultimately dismissed the case, citing lack of affidavit as well. Why do you cases, it defines credulity. Fatiga Ayers testified that he told her that it made sense to do it. Here's a factual dispute with Mr. Brooks. Fatiga Ayers is pretty emphatic in the trial that he told her it made sense to do it. He filed this notice of appeal on time, and then the brief was due on November 7th, 1995. It was not until December 18th, 1995, that he filed requested a two-day extension of time, which would have been December 20th. Even at that point, it wasn't until December 22nd that he actually filed the brief in the appellate court. Basically, not the appellate court accepted it, and again, just ruled against it.
You need to sum up. Your red light's on. You need to sum up.
Okay. The elevator situation in this area, we ascertained the elevator was working. We never received the jurisdictional document that he said he was going to provide us to file on this court. We think, therefore, that all of the violations alleged found, in fact, he is guilty of.
Counsel,
yes.
You have asked for restitution of $500.
First of all, was there a fee agreement that was a contingency on top of that? Fatiga Ayers, he had a minimum non-refundable retainer, but it wasn't a contingency.
Okay, so you say that it's similar to the person that is not
taxed. Well, it was similar, but it was the same one, but he didn't have any contingencies.
So there was no contingency.
Yes, it was similar.
You have a fee charge of $1,000. And you have restitution of
$2,500.
Why is this?
Well, he did do some work on the case, so he's kind of compensation.
He did
compensate
something for
$1,500.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Brooks, you saved almost 2 minutes of your time.
2 minutes.
A little less.
Strictly as a jurisdictional document, that document was provided to the Clemson Bar Association whereby we attempted to file a second this court that was unsuccessful. As to the opportunity, opportunity to obtain an affidavit, there was an effort finally to obtain an affidavit without success. In terms of getting someone other than the physician who indicated he would testify or give an affidavit, was sent here on our behalf, our being was there. So the question why we went to Mr. Ayers, my law clerk, Mr. Ayers, and her mother together, all meetings I had, that came to Mrs. Ayers' attention. I quoted what I thought would be a charge for a physician to review, file, and also to give a statement if he or she chose to do so in terms of the standard of care then to the physician, the former human physician. Mrs. Ayers did not agree to the same, and as a result, since the volume of possible recovery was low and Mrs. Ayers was required to pay the expenses of the case, it was her decision not for me to go to find a new physician. I wanted to bring that up. As to the Jacksons, being unsophisticated or sophisticated, this and Mrs. Jackson were understandable folks. I took no effort or made no effort to deceive them at any time. They knew what the non-refundable fee was, as we discussed earlier. That fee was a paid filing fee, and the fee for researching, drafting, and trying to serve the complaint, which this court knows had to be done with defendants by certified. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised for opinion.